why do we need to triple the capacity of the pipeline when, like I said, we're clearly heading in another direction? Yeah. So why do we need to, and how are we going to meet these climate targets while at the same time building more infrastructure that is going to, you know, it has a life cycle of, what, 30, 40, 50 years. So they're not always straightforward. One of the other things that I read when I was looking into this was that most of the opposition is from the lower 48. So they're referring to basically people in the South. And like I said, you know, you could see a fair bit of support among Democrats, Republicans, Independents, and Indigenous people. So it's really in terms of the Willow Project, it's really people that aren't living there for the most part. Yeah. Like, obviously, there is Indigenous opposition there, and there's probably non-Indigenous opposition there. But it's people like us living down here, you know, in warmer climates that are opposing this. So there is that aspect that I think is important to consider in this dynamic. Trans Mountain was a little different in the sense that, you know, it went from rural north all the way through and here to a very, you know, metropolitan south as well. And so you had opposition all the way up and down. But in terms of, you know, activism, like I said, of all the, like, I went to a protest at the bottom of the mountain here in 2017. I had my kids with me and I had students that were protesting here, here on Burnaby Mountain. And it was in some ways, it was a little ironic that what appeared to almost kill the project was, like I said, the marketplace, was the price of oil. So I'm not saying those two aren't connected. They are connected in a way, like I said, if there's generating enough interest in an alternative way, that can have a greater impact, but it's not one that you can directly, it's hard to directly tie it to, mm-hmm. what am I doing and how is that changing? It's more of what they call like the social movement becomes more normal. Mm-hmm. It becomes mm-hmm. more of like a society-wide expectation. So I think there is something to be said about that, like these conversations, like people educating. And I saw that reference to all the TikTok stuff. But again, it's so easy and fleeting. I mean, TikTok, you literally, you swipe to the next thing and it's like cat videos or the next thing and it's something else. So our attention spans are so short.
Yeah, for sure. And especially like on social media, you could sign a petition for the Willow Project to stop it. People wrote so many letters, I think 70,000 letters to the White House. And I think they collected over 2 million people like that signed up for or against the Willow Project. And it's crazy how much attention it gets now. But before that, I mean, that's already said, it started in 1999, and then now all of a sudden it explodes because now it is approved. And people on social media know about it. But I think that also we live in a very, how can I say that, like in a fast time where people live through their life and the time goes by really fast and don't really focus on things specifically. So I think that's also a matter that we should be aware of. And it is interesting. And I think especially on social media, many people can spread fake news and never know if this is right or not. So when you want to sign something or if you want to participate in something, please do research before you sign anything or be part of an organization. Do your research, because there's some cruel environmental organization as well. So be aware of that. As I said, can be hypocritical. And so they can claim, for the environment, but in reality, they're not really for the environment, just for profit. So try to support nonprofit organization, because this is the best way to support the climate and to make a change, because most of the nonprofit organizations are really, really good. And do research before you support anything. It's really, really important. And yeah, we were talking about a lot of about the past, but also about the future. So where do you see, or how is our future impacted by such a project, and what does that mean for indigenous communities? So when you look like in 30 years, you said you're not good at predicting, but where do you see like issues, or how can the impact can be described?
Yeah, it's hard to say. I mean, I hesitate to comment on the far north specifically too much, but I do know that rising temperatures, for example, and disruptions are happening quicker up mm-hmm. north.
Yeah.
So the you know, we might feel it at a particular range here along the 49th parallel, but above the 60th, I think we're learning that they're more severe and quicker than we might be experiencing in more temperate climates. So I think that's obviously a concern, and a big concern for these indigenous communities that historically have relied upon wildlife. A lot of people have seen that video of the polar bear just swimming around, like,
yeah.
You know, it's like this heartbreaking thing, the ice disappearing, the tundra, the permafrost, releasing lots of carbon when it disappears. So there's lots of issues which I know that are going to be really tough for the next 20, 30 years, even if we stopped all activity right now. We've reached a certain inertia of how bad, there's a bunch of stuff that's going to be inevitable. So I think in some ways also these communities, local communities, are feeling these impacts, and at the same time also feeling very vulnerable economically and socially. Now in Alaska they have a different way of organizing. They're called the 1971 Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act created corporations.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of these villages or autonomous communities being recognized as governments, they are, you know, if we were members, we'd have shares, like literal shares mm-hmm. in the corporation. So you have, I think there's 13 Alaska Native corporations, 12 regional, and the 13th is like everyone from Alaska who doesn't live there anymore. They don't mm-hmm. live in their home territory. So there are interesting sort of different governance relationships, which in other places, I argue, has an impact on how you see these issues or how you see these problems. And then there's, like I said, there's that immediate aspect of how do I feed my family and can I afford to still live here, or do I have to move, mm-hmm. you know, to California, or do I have to move somewhere where we can make a living, which is really tragic, you know, in the long term sense. I do think so. One of the things I wanted to touch on a little bit as well is what is the post-carbon future look like? And what are those impacts on indigenous communities? So I'm starting to do a bit of research on what it would take, and you may have seen this already, how much more lithium, copper, all of these rare metals and minerals are required for these electric vehicles and mm-hmm. solar panels.
Oh, yeah.
There's a whole new world of extraction, particularly in mining, which I don't think we fully grasp that. There's a great book by Angela Luke and Emily Eaton, and they have a number of co-authors called The End of This World, and it just came out in January, mm-hmm. and it's about just transitions, but just transitions from the perspective of indigenous peoples. And one of the things they say is we're not going to make it through this time in a just transition way if we just replace every gas car with an electric car. Like if we all just trade. We need more infrastructure. We need better public transport. We need more efficient transport. And we cannot live exactly as we've lived for the last 100 years for the next 100 years. Like it just, you can't switch one for the other, because the impact of meeting all of those needs for all those Teslas and Volts and kinds of vehicles is still very devastating for the earth. I can't remember, you know, you can look this up, like to get an electric vehicle, the footprint, the carbon footprint that it produces just to make it is quite significant. And you have to drive it, I don't know, for, you know, a certain period of time, like years before you make up that difference when you mm-hmm. switched from your old car. So switching out one for one is not going to work. And in that particular book, The End of This World, I really like it because they say, you know, we need a radical transformation, not just in the way we think about the economy and energy and transport, but, you know, they were talking about defunding police and the military and all of these things, where they could take the money from, because they recognize that all of this is going to cost, you know. The Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives released a paper about investments in renewable energy and the post-carbon economy, and they estimate that we're making probably 10% of the investment that we need to. Like, we need to be investing, instead of $5 billion, actually it's more than 10%, because they talked about somewhere in the neighborhood of $250 billion. But Indigenous peoples as well. So if you look at the history of British Columbia and Manitoba and Quebec, you have communities that have been completely displaced by mega hydro dams, like big hydroelectric projects, because they flood all of the territory. They flood all of the lands where they hunt and gather. And in certain places, they also release methyl mercury. When you disrupt the land, it causes all of these other impacts. So that was one of the things I always like to remind my students about, is that the alternative is in many ways better, in the sense that we're trying to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, but we're also dealing with all kinds of other issues and contaminants from this big push. And, you know, countries have, like France has banned fossil fuels, or like new fossil fuel projects, but they just buy it from, you know, other places in the interim. And not just British Columbia, Canada has a mandate that all new vehicles will have to be zero emission vehicles by 2035, I believe. So to meet those targets is going to require a whole lot of extraction.
Yeah.
And so part of the change has to be not just what can I do that's the same, but not as impactful environmentally, but taking a more broader look at how I live my life and making changes.
Oh, very true, actually. This is so true, because, I mean, I can only refer to myself. I started driving last year, and, you know, it is easier to just take the car, but you have to be aware of what it will do to the environment and how you can work on what you do. I mean, it starts with separating trash or taking the bus instead of the car. So you can start by working on yourself and how big your footprint is. So be aware of that. And starting with yourself is a good step in the right direction. And what I was thinking while we're talking about renewable energies and stuff, in 2020, when the pandemic started, actually so many great things happened in our nature. So I heard about the water in Italy became clear again, and the dolphins returned to, I think, was it Venice? I think it was in Venice. So it's great how, I mean, this is only an example, and so many things happened in 2020, and then our normal life started to go on again, and then we kind of started to leave another footprint again. So starting by yourself is a good way to save the environment. I don't like the term of saving the environment, but helping the environment to not be destroyed. Because when I was doing the research, I thought, okay, we humans, we are kind of destroying ourselves in the end if we continue to live like we did the last 100 years. And as Sarah said, I heard about that actually the battery of a Tesla, for example, is so, so bad for the environment, and all with all of the chemicals. And if we want to get rid of it, it's really, really bad for the environment. So you have to take that. And I think it's a process. It's not like, okay, we've cut off all of, you're not allowed to drive any cars. Like, this is not how it is going to work. We depend on such things. And I think I also read that actually Joe Biden agreed to approve this project, actually, because he wanted to be more independent, and he doesn't want to depend on countries, oil countries like Russia, for example. And yeah, it's it is hard to deal with that. And also, like, when it comes to economics and environment, there's like these two opposites, and it's really interesting. And while I was doing research, also I read that you actually your work is also about how indigenous leaders try to be more environmental responsible. So how they're interact with the environment, how to be more environmentally or don't leave an environmental footprint. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Well, I think one of the things I like to stress is that all Indigenous communities are quite unique and diverse.
Mm-hmm.
So I never try to talk about like one Indigenous way or, you know, one culture. But I think there are a lot of examples and a lot of stories. And I like to remind people that, you know, almost every Indigenous community has origin stories. They also have stories where there are really profound lessons about how to act and how to behave, not only amongst ourselves, but how we treat animals, how we treat the land. And I was just hearing one from Gitgat, so a Tsimshian story about, you know, it was basically a lesson about how they engaged with the mountain goats. And the reason I like to bring that up is because it reminds us that we are all human beings and we all had to learn. And it's not like Indigenous peoples are like magically better or more, you know what I mean? Like they're not natural environmentalists. I think all human beings have to strive for some sort of equilibrium and to live in reciprocal ways with their environment. And then, you know, you have various economic and political factors that make that more challenging and harder. Capitalism as a system of profit maximization is always going to lead you into trouble, particularly in a place like Canada or Alaska, where you depend highly on resources like uranium or mm-hmm. oil or natural gas. I do appreciate that, you know, in many ways, Indigenous communities have strong embedded values and worldviews in living in greater harmony with their environment. But I like just to remind people that that wasn't like a natural thing or it's not an instinctual thing, that every community needs to learn their boundaries and learn to communicate with the earth and with the animals so that you have these respectful relationships. You know, I saw that Greenpeace was one of the organizations that filed a lawsuit recently. There's been a number, I think, Earth Justice and a number of lawsuits to try and stop the Willow Project. And, of course, Greenpeace has this history in Canada, in particular with Indigenous peoples, where that was really impacting the seal hunt in, you know, like northern Quebec and the Northwest Territories, to the point where Greenpeace actually years and years later issued an apology and have tried to make adjustments to how they deal with Indigenous peoples, especially these northern communities that rely on, you know, which is almost like 100% protein diet. Like mm-hmm. If you look at that landscape and that territory, they rely heavily on mammals, basically,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
To hunt. So I think there's lots of ways in which Indigenous peoples feel ambivalent about these projects. They have immediate financial needs, but they also have this sort of worldview and culture that has developed over time to recognize that they can't take more than they need. They can't afford to be greedy. They can't afford to create imbalance in the environment. And I think that those are good lessons. And I think mm-hmm. mainstream society has gone away from that.
Yeah, for sure. Especially when we look on not only hunting, but also fishing. I mean, our ocean is almost empty. I mean, I spoke to my mom and she said, yeah, when we went on vacation, I saw all of these fish. And now we go on vacation and I don't see any fish at all, like no fish. It's empty. And that shows me how impacted the ocean is too. And I was actually listening to that podcast, as I already said, and it says how to save the ocean. And it's more focusing on the ocean, but they were talking about the Willow Project too, because you have to think about it. It will also affect the ocean, not only the indigenous community and the wildlife on land, but also the whales, the seals, the fish in the ocean. I mean, it could also lead to an oil explosion, or as the media is calling the Willow Project, a carbon bomb. So when oil leaks, it could be lead to a disaster, an oil disaster. And we have to be aware of that too. And I like to refer to that moment, this realization when I went swimming and I saw no fish, and it scares me. It scares me a lot. So it's really important to talk about it. And especially, Greenpeace, it is a good organization, but it has a pros and cons. So as you already said, that they're owned the indigenous communities up north an apology. So as I already said, do research on how the environment organization act and what they do and what's their history before you support those organizations. We're almost at the end of the show. It's crazy. And I'm so glad that you're here and it could answer all of these questions I had, because it's such an interesting topic and I could talk about it for hours. And I have more questions to ask you, but we're running out of time, unfortunately, because it's a huge project, it's a huge topic, and it's so much to talk about. It's hard to just, I don't know, shrink it in 1 hour. So I have one last question for you. So you are also Indigenous, and as an Indigenous person, how does this project make you feel? Because I tried actually to reach out to Afanmisa, which is the Indigenous group here, organization here at SFU, but unfortunately we're busy because finals are coming up and stuff. So I would like to ask you this as an Indigenous person.
I mean, I think the message that I often try to share is to try and have empathy for what's happening on a local situation. And so that doesn't lead to like any particular response. But if you look at this, for example, we're looking at ConocoPhillips, which is a multi-billion dollar oil company based in Texas. And you have communities of several hundred people in some cases. So when we're looking at people speaking about the economics of it, or, you know, the revenues, they're not the same thing. Like, these entities are quite different. You have, on the one hand, people literally trying to meet basic needs to buy food, to live, and have work. And you have a for-profit corporation that's made billions and billions of dollars all over the world. So they're not exactly the same. So when I say that as an Indigenous person, I always try to empathize with the leaders, with the people that whale hunter and Alaska state representative, for example, he said, this is the road that Indigenous leaders have to walk. You know, you, on the one hand, you're living a subsistence lifestyle, and then the next day you're in a state legislature, you know, dealing with these issues. So it's always more complicated than it seems. And I do appreciate that, like you said, to do your research, to get informed, as much as possible. Especially now in the time of social media, because things are so fast, things are quick, and you it's hard to tell who's telling the truth and what people's motivations are. You have stuff that comes up on your email, or whenever you open Google, it's like, here are the stories that you should be interested in. Yeah. And I'm getting more and more mistrustful of the stuff that just feels random. Like right now, our conversation. So I've had my phone in my pocket, and for the rest of the day, it'll probably be all kinds of weird stuff about the things we've been talking about, because it's passively listening.
So scary. It's really scary. Yeah. Actually, when I started the research, not ads, but videos, TikToks popped up about the Willow Project. And it's kind of scary that your phone knows you so well. And social media has its pros and cons, but I would say it's a good way to inform yourself fast, quickly. You don't have to go to a library and borrow a book and then read the book, and then this is how you do your research. You can just go on Google and find some stuff. But we also have a lot of fake news, fake articles, media that is trying to deform our reality. So be aware of that. And also, as I said before, you support someone or an organization that is opposed to Willow Project or tries to support our climate, being climate neutrally. So be aware of that, and before you support that, inform yourself about it. And I was wondering what you can do, so that is the last comment here, what you can do to stop the Willow Project, not to stop it, but to maybe to reduce it, so that we have a good step in the right direction. You can first educate yourself, which is very, very important. So it took me like 2 weeks to actually have this knowledge that I have right now. So you don't need to work on that or research on it for like two weeks. But I mean, if it's like only 1 hour, it's fine. Or read a book or whatever. So there's so many sources that you can use. And the book that you mentioned, what was the name again?
It's called The End of This World.
The End of This World. Yeah, I will link this in our archives because it's actually really interesting. And I always like to educate myself and to learn about new stuff. And it's a very recent topic, so it's really important.
Yeah, if you can pick it up, the first author is Angel Alouk, A-L-O-O-K, and it's Between the Lines Press, which is a co-op publishing company in Ontario, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I will link the book in our archives if you are interested. And share the Willow Project on social media. Talk about it to your friends. Educate your friends and your family about it, because my family didn't know about the Willow Project before I told them. So share about it and raise awareness so that we don't forget about it and continue talking about it. That's really, really really important. And if you want to do something, you could join a climate organization, but do research before joining or signing something. Yeah, that's what I can say. And thank you so much for being here today. And we have a song, actually, because we talked a lot, and now I would like to play some music at the end of the show. The next show is coming up, Democracy Now, with some news, but we have one last song. It's called Bets Are Burning by Midnight Oil. Actually, it's kind of funny because Midnight Oil kind of fits to today's topic. So yeah, thank you so much, Clifford, for being here today. And
thanks for having me.
Yeah,
I'm a child of the 70s and 80s, so this is going to bring me back.
Yeah, throwback. So please enjoy the last song for today, Bets Are Burning by Midnight Oil.
Jesus.